ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
The world right now is a disaster. It's easy to feel helpless. But there was a moment when millions of people around the world said enough. I'm Sisson Kim Simong. Join me for Boycott, the fight to end apartheid, how Australians joined others around the world to push back against racism and won.
Whites-only teams, we thought that to the average Australian, that would be despicable.
Boycott, the fight to end apartheid. Search for ABC Rewind on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Soul Search, the show about contemporary spirituality. I'm Meredith Lake, and I bet you can imagine this. You're at home, halfway through cooking the dinner, and there's a knock at the door. You weren't expecting anyone. Who could it be? It's your neighbour from next door. Do you know their name? How do you feel about them just showing up like that? And could you, would you, rely on each other in a pickle, maybe to borrow something or deal with a bigger problem? If your honest answer is, well, no, don't feel bad. There's lots of things in the way of us being good neighbours. We're busy, we're broke, we live in a highly individualised society, and housing insecurity might mean that we have to move all the time. But being a good neighbour is a human instinct that runs really deep. It has ancient and even sacred roots that you're going to hear about. But right now, I'm with Nick Tebby. He's the Executive Officer of Relationships Australia. Hi, Nick.
G'day, Meredith. Thanks for having me.
How well do you know your neighbours?
Look, I'm pleased to say I know them very well. We have a very connected street. I'm very lucky.
That's great. I have to admit, in my current housing situation, I don't really know my neighbours. It's the first time in a long time that I've had to admit that.
Yeah, right.
And I'm kind of actually sad about it.
Well, look, it's not uncommon, as you say. We are busy. There's a lot of things happening in the world that keep us distracted. But it's one of those things that if you can find the time to get to know them, great benefits can come your way.
So why are you big on this? I mean, beyond your own life, I mean. I know that
Sure.
Relationships Australia runs, you know, an annual Neighbour Day campaign. But why? Why are you so big on the neighbour thing?
Sure. Well, look, Relationships Australia is an organisation that's been working across the country for over 75 years, supporting people in Australia to have healthy, respectful relationships. Traditionally, that was, you know, your family, your loved ones, your immediate, close-knit family. But what we've seen through our research, through the work that we do with clients, is actually there are a whole range of different kinds of relationships that shape who we are and that provide us the support and the connection that we need when we need it. And one of those is our neighbourhood, the community that we live in. And it doesn't necessarily mean the person living next door, although that's a great place to start. It can mean the broader community, but it's the people you connect with on a social level who provide something to your life that's outside of that immediate family connection that can actually bring you a whole lot of enrichment and support when the time comes that you might need that.
I mean, those other relationships that you mentioned, Nick, with our relatives, maybe their parents, partners, children. I mean, they're the kind of relationships that lots of us are going to seek some professional help to navigate, right, at some point in our lives. But neighbour relationships, why do you think we need to kind of just maybe give that a bit of attention right now?
Yeah, look, I think it's a whole lot of things. And as you said in the intro, you know, we've become so busy and disjointed from our immediate physical world. And so it's easy. The neighbourhood connections, the community connections, are the ones that are sort of the easiest to forget about because they're sort of there. You don't have to do much. They're there. So that means we don't spend as much time thinking about them. However, what we've seen through our research with our Neighbours Every Day campaign is that if we do invest a bit of time and a bit of effort into building those connections, there are a huge amount of physical and mental health benefits that flow from having that sense of belonging and connection into our neighbourhood.
I'd love to hear more about that because, you know, the thing about neighbours, right, is that we don't exactly choose them. You know, no, you don't get to decide who rents the next apartment or who, you know, who maybe buys a house in your street or something. It's not always rosy. is all I'm saying. So what are the benefits?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it takes all kinds. And we hear a lot about those pointy, tricky neighbourhood disputes and issues where things need to be managed. But, you know, so many of these things would not become an issue if we just took the time to get to know each other. And I think neighbourhoods are actually fantastic for this because of that very fact that you mentioned, that we haven't chosen them. They're here. We don't necessarily have a shared identity. And in fact, the only thing bringing us together is where we live. And so that's actually an opportunity to learn, to be open to different perspectives, and to create that sharing across what might be otherwise seen as traditional social barriers and things like that. And if we can get that practice right, then that's actually going to improve social cohesion. It's going to improve resilience when times are tough. And as I said, it's going to open up the doors to us to maybe some relationships, some friendships, some connections that we never would have otherwise had.
So what have you learned about how to take that step, how to lean into our neighbourly relationships and begin fostering the kind of communities that you're talking about?
At all times, people need to practice self-care and make sure they're not making themselves feel uncomfortable. But what we've noticed is that small things are actually where the real difference happens and the magic happens. And so it starts with a smile, a nod, a wave. It becomes a chat over the letterbox, an offer to bring the bins in when they're away over the weekend. And those sorts of simple acts don't necessarily need to become detailed political conversations or anything else that might lead to conflict. You never know. But they're just that idea that, hey, we're here for each other. You know, we're here to support each other. You know, my neighbour the other day was harvesting his lemons in his backyard, and he yelled over the fence, "Nick, I've got a few spare. Do you want some?" Of course I said yes. Nothing beats fresh lemons. I said, just keep them coming. But, you know, that's natural stuff. It's not forced. It's not some big grand gesture. It's just the everyday getting to know you and knowing that you're around kind of stuff. And it's that creates this sense of identity for us that, yeah, I identify with my community. I identify with my neighbourhood. And I know that I've got that behind me if times get tough, if I need help, if I need support. There are people around who at least I know that I can call on.
And, you know, we do in this country, right? We've seen flooding across so much of Australia just in very recent times. We can all think of bushfire disasters that have somehow impinged on us or people we know. There is a point too, I guess, where your neighbour could be your lifesaver or vice versa. There's kind of a lot at stake in that sense too.
There sure is. There's a lot of research that shows, and I think this is actually a really uniquely Australian thing, that we're really good when times get tough at you know, rallying around the most vulnerable, helping out, making sure everyone gets back on their feet. And that's a real sense of mateship and support that I think we should be proud of. But I think, you know, what we'd love to see is that we don't wait for the next disaster, the next thing to go wrong. Let's actually get out there and get to know each other now. Because the research that we've done through the campaign is really compelling. Once we know that we've got those connections and in the back of our mind it's stored away that, yeah, if there is another natural disaster, I know Mary down the road will be able to help out with this, or Joe up the road might need my help with that. We've connected those dots and we've got a greater sense of resilience, and that has a real direct impact on our life satisfaction, on our sense of well-being. And you know, the benefits, as I said before, are huge and varied for everyone involved.
Well, Nick, that's a lot of good reasons to say g'day at the letterbox or to bring in my neighbour's bin. Thank you, and I hope you have a terrific neighbour day yourself. Thanks so much for joining me on Soul Search.
Thank you, Meredith. It's a real pleasure.
Nick Tebbe, National Executive Officer of Relationships Australia, the organisation behind the Neighbours Everyday campaign. You can find out more about that, as well as some tips for connecting with your neighbours, by following the link from the Soul Search website. This is Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. Meredith Lake here, keeping you company. I love the sound of fresh lemons shared over the back fence. And for me, it underlines that physical space, the literal neighbourhood, really matters. Dr. Karina Kraminski is a community builder. She's also written books about spirituality in urban areas and in edge spaces. Hi, Karina. Now, this might sound a little obvious, but who would you say is my neighbour?
Hi, Meredith. Usually, I think when we think who is our neighbour, we're thinking a lot more globally, but I like to take it really literally and ask people who lives next door to you. Do you know their name? I'm a big fan of the microspace. They are your neighbours. They're the people that have been put in front of you for you to connect with and build relationship with.
But why do you think that? Because we do have lots of communities, right? Don't we have online neighbourhoods, so to speak, or the neighbourhood of the workplace? Like, so why are you a fan of the, what did you say, the micro neighbourhood?
Yeah, the microspace. I love the small. Yeah, I think place is really important. To be human means to be placed somewhere. You're placed in a particular country, in a particular city, and in a particular neighbourhood. To be displaced means there's something dehumanizing going on there if you're displaced. And I even think physical spaces have soul. So I often talk about the soul of a particular neighborhood. And so I think that is all interconnected and intermingles with the fact of connecting with relationship, in relationship with other people.
So tell me about your microspace, Karina. Tell me about your neighbourhood. What's it like? How would you describe it for people who maybe don't live in it?
So I love the ideal of neighbourhood and the practice of neighbouring because I have had such a good experience in my little neighbourhood of Surry Hills. I remember when I was thinking about moving into the area, I just found that it was a neighbourhood that was very relational, and people in my neighbourhood look out for one another. That's not to idealise it. There's things that go wrong as well. But at the same time, for some reason, there was something very enchanting. Mixing with all sorts of different diverse communities, it's a really good thing. But we're all kind of stuck together in the same geographical space, which we want to honour and love and learn what it means to kind of get along with one another despite and because of our differences.
I mean, Surry Hills is in the inner city of Sydney. Mm-hmm. It's almost a walkable neighbourhood in a way that a lot of neighbourhoods aren't these days. Most of us live, you know, not in the urban areas, but in the suburban areas of the country. How important do you think that urban quality is to your experience of your neighbourhood?
Oh, I think it's really important, and that's what led me to write my book on urban spirituality, because I think there is something quite particular about urban spaces. Things are more dense, things are intermingled, there's a lot of activity, there's a lot of diversity, and people, like you just said, people walk everywhere. I don't use my car very much at all, and so that means that when I step out of my house, I'm going to bump into a neighbour, I'm going to bump into people that I know. People gather in public spaces because their houses are small. Where they live is usually quite small, and so they like going out, they like hanging out with other people. A lot of people have dogs, and so, you know, you end up getting to know the dog's name before you know the person's name. I mean, in fact, you know, that's how I've made a lot of friends, just connecting with their dogs and getting to know them a little bit more. And I can remember one person that, you know, I started chatting with her about her dog, and, you know, 8 years later, we're almost best friends.
You and the dog, or
yeah,
you and the human?
Both.
I mean, Surry Hills is a fascinating example at the same time, because I suppose, like most inner suburbs of any Australian city, it's been subject to a lot of change, not least gentrification. Mm-hmm. The dream of living in the inner city is inaccessible to a lot of people who might love the idea of what you're talking about, Karina. We live in a housing crisis, and that creates transience as well as unaffordability for so many people. So how would you say Surry Hills has kind of ridden that roller coaster over the time you've been there, and even over longer?
Yeah, I think that's something that everyone in the community needs to negotiate, and we're constantly navigating and negotiating that wave. There's usually a tension between corporate interests, political interests, and then just local interests. You've got people who really see Sydney as a global city, and so they kind of don't really care what happens to the local too much. And then you've got locals who are really just trying to stick up for their neighbourhood, for the soul of their neighbourhood, which sometimes can, you know, they can get a bit extreme and fall into that NIMBYism. You know, my neighbourhood is Surry Hills, and that's very different to the neighbourhood of Paddington or the neighbourhood of Ultimo or Chippendale. We've all got our distinct soul, character, flavour. So
what's the soul of Surry Hills?
Oh, soul is an interesting word, isn't it?
Yeah.
I've been thinking about that a lot. I mean, for me, soul means a part of soul is identity. So what's the actual identity of Surry Hills? And with the gentrification process happening, I think that gets more and more difficult to define because gentrification tends to make everything look the same. And when everything looks the same, becomes homogenous and bland, I think that's when a neighbourhood or a person loses their soul. If you think, you know, what do we say is soulless, or how does somebody lose their soul, or what when we say music has soul, what do we mean by that? I do think it's got something to do with beauty, aesthetics, and identity, narrative, memory. And once you get people in
diversity.
And diversity, yeah.
Is what you're saying, like that homogenization is the opposite of yeah.
So one little example is the cafes in Surry Hills, which have always been very unique and particular to the place. But because of the gentrification, a lot have closed down and had to move out. And so what you get is franchises coming in. And so they look exactly the same as they do in every neighbourhood. And so, you know, that's a tension point as well for us, that we get people who carry the memory and the history of Surry Hills leaving and others coming in who belong to a franchise. And I think their aims are different compared to those who came in a long time ago and have built relationship in the community. So we're continually negotiating that in our neighbourhood.
Mm. It's interesting, this idea of the village as a kind of companion to the idea of the neighbourhood. The other term in my mind, Karina, is perhaps a little quaint, but the idea of the parish, this is one that goes back a long way in kind of Christian concepts of space. The idea of the parish as a place with maybe a church, a priest, that, you know, even used to have festivals where people walked the boundaries together, praying for the harvest and its success of their neighbours and those kinds of things. It's a very kind of medieval kind of concept in a way. I guess I'm asking you to elaborate on that unit of space, the neighbourhood, the parish, whatever you want to call it. Do you think it has not just a soul but a potentially religious quality to it?
Quaint. I love that word, quaint. And I wonder if people are craving quaint at the moment. And so,
are you?
Yes. We're craving quaint. We're craving analog, I think. And so we've got a lot of really wonderful events that happen in our neighbourhood that, you know, people might describe as quaint, but people are flocking to those spaces. I think that the church is one part of the ecology of the neighbourhood. And so within the neighbourhood, you've got different community organisations. We have a wonderful neighbourhood centre in our Surry Hills, and we have some beautiful cafes. And we also have churches. And churches, for me, aren't the only place where you can experience the numinous. I think you experience the numinous in church and the other institutions and events and people. The parish idea links really well with that, I think. And I think it's what people are after today, some kind of grounding, some kind of ritual to ground them in reality when everybody's asking, you know, what's real and what's not.
Fascinating to link the neighbourhood with the experience of the numinous. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see that happening? Where have you encountered the numinous in the neighbourhood?
Oh, I have. And often it's through intentional activities and sometimes incidental activities. So just I'll often walk out of my home and I have to leave 10 minutes extra because I will be bumping into people that I know.
So you do that?
I do that. I do that.
Yes.
I leave them. It's a spiritual discipline for me, which I call marginality. So just leaving margins of space so that I know that I'm going to have interactions with people. And when I start chatting with people, I do we do end up having very deep conversations, and it's because of proximity, because we're constantly interacting with one another in the same space. So I know the gossip. I know, you know, if somebody's doing well, or if their refrigerator is broken down, or if their mother's in hospital, or if their dog has gone to the vet. We know all of these things. And these little incidental conversations often go deeper. And that's where I experience the numinous. You know, we end up talking about death and about what matters in life and what is important and what's not important today and some of the troubles that are going on overseas and sometimes also manifest in our backyards. We end up having those deep conversations. And for me, they're spiritual conversations. And I encounter the transcendence in those spaces.
You said earlier, Karina, that neighbourhoods can be places of friction. They're not necessarily ideal spaces. And I mean, the proverbial, you know, argument over the fence, is kind of a trope of so much of our entertainment as well as our own experience. I wonder if you could say a little more about that, because people are very different and have different needs and rub up against each other in close proximity. What does that look like in Surry Hills? And I guess, how does that temper your idea of the neighbourhood as where it's all at?
I think that a lot of good can come from conflict if it's handled well. And I think there's something about my neighbourhood, and this is what I mean when I say that I've had a good experience, that even though there's conflict, we tend to work it out. It doesn't always resolve, but we tend to either work it out, talk it out, or sometimes it has to manifest in some kind of clash in order to be dealt with. One example, and it's an example that's quite well known in our neighbourhood, is about 10 years ago or so, there was a horrible incident in a laneway in Surry Hills where a lesbian woman was raped in an alleyway. And, you know, normally it was, you know, awful, and particularly in an area which is supposed to be quite safe for the LGBTQI community. We have a very strong representation of the gay community in our neighbourhood. And so this happened right around the corner from a pub, and people were so outraged about this that community organisations got together and they commissioned an artist to do an artwork in that laneway and also to write some words on that laneway to commemorate what had happened, to remember and to say that we will not stand for this in Surry Hills and we do not want this to happen again. And people go there, they light candles, they remember. It's become a bit of a memorial space. And so, you know, that's an example of a very strong, awful clash that happened, but it's also an example of the conflict manifesting to the point that the rest of the community said, we will not stand for this. And so I love the way that this happens in our community. There's clashes, there's conflict, there's violence, and yet somehow there's a desire to resolve what is going on. And I love that again, that in the micro space, we can do that. Sometimes the global space feels so out of control, but in the micro space, we can actually negotiate some of these things and work together for good and respond and react and yell and scream and build artworks and, you know, do what we need to keep that space a beautiful space, even though it's also a very messy space.
Mm. Because they're not disconnected, are they? The global and the local, the macro and the micro spaces, as you say, Karina. Tell me about the Jewish baker in your neighbourhood and what's happened with their business.
So there's a bakery just around the corner from where we live, and he is Jewish and quite a well-known celebrity chef. I think he had his bakery there for about 3-4 years, and we didn't know this, but throughout the whole time he was getting death threats. And he was pretty vocal on social media about things. So he also got his bakery graffitied. And I think at the time of the Bondi massacre, he just decided that he couldn't take this anymore. And he decided to shut his bakery down. And the community just was grieving that what is happening overseas came globally, came very locally to us, right on our front doors, and we were confronted with this tension, this division, this violence, and this reality. So we were all really sad that, you know, firstly, Surry Hills is losing some of its cultural diversity by him leaving, and also that this act of violence has affected him so much that he had to leave, and that, you know, what's happening overseas is brought to our doorsteps, and we don't want that. We want this to be a safe space, but of course we can't. We can't completely protect our community. And so, yeah, it was just something that we all wrestled with and grieved about for quite some time. And yeah.
What have you learned, I guess, about holding the space for those conversations, for naming the violence in a community, and for communities to take a stand on something, to say, no, you're welcome, or no, that violence is not okay? Not every community has a neighbourhood centre like Surry Hills. So what have you learned about what's needed to enable and continue those ongoing conversations about who and what a neighbourhood and its members want to be?
I think it takes some individuals who are really interested and care for the neighbourhood. And so we have a lot of people in our neighbourhood that are like that. And it does help, of course, if you have a space, whether it's a neighbourhood centre or some other place where you can meet. So we have been in our neighbourhood for about 10 years now and connected quite a bit with the neighbourhood centre and artists and the business community and the different sections that make up this community. And we actually do have a gathering in our home once a month where some of the neighbours come into this space, and we treat it as a bit of a sacred space. So we gather and we talk about the deep issues of our neighbourhood or of our world and what's going on in our lives. And we also have decided to have a common purse where we will collect some money and think about who in the neighbourhood is struggling that we might contribute to them relationally or financially. And so we love this space because we get to sort of steward or look after the neighbourhood, and anybody's welcome in that space. And so I think that can happen anywhere. It just takes a few people who are caring and who are interested to build those connections, and then to gather people and sort of share what's going on in their lives and think about, you know, whether they want to input into the neighbourhood in some particular way. And that can happen, I think that can happen anywhere, particularly with places that don't have a neighbourhood centre or may not be as well resourced. I think it really just takes some people who are really keen.
It probably does. I love this idea that the neighbourhood's where it's at. I love this idea of a face-to-face community where people know each other really well, and that knowledge leads to a kind of neighbourly love in the way you're describing. And yet I think it's really tricky and perhaps rarer than it could be. I don't know. Is the neighbourhood still underrated in your view? Is it an edge space, a marginal thing that we need to bring back to the centre? Or how would you reflect on, I guess, where neighbourhoods are at across the landscape of our communities today?
Yeah, I think there is a challenge and it's possibly happening mostly through the digital communities that are forming. Having said that, I'm not against digital communities. I think they are very important. I think some people who can't connect physically for whatever reason can connect digitally, and I think that's really helpful for them. I'm involved in some digital communities and facilitate those spaces as well with other people. I think it's great. But for me, there's nothing like looking at somebody eye to eye and connecting with them that way. And again, that physical space of the neighbourhood. But I do think it takes some people to advocate for that neighbourhood, to be people who not just come into a neighbourhood, use it for whatever reason, and then go out again, but people who commit to staying. I call it the spiritual discipline of stickability, just staying in one place for a long time and just really being advocates for that space. I think it's possible, but I do think it requires some sacrifice in a lot of ways. But I do
sacrifice.
Sacrifice in the sense of not saying no to opportunities that come up because you want to stay in the neighbourhood and you want to build those relationships. So, I mean, I realise there's privilege in saying that. Some people need to move around a lot for their work or financial reasons.
I mean, but you spoke earlier about being forced into a kind of unchosen mobility, being displaced as one of the great dehumanising forces in the world. And that can happen on micro levels.
That's right.
I think we see degrees of that dehumanisation in the way our economy currently functions for many, many people.
That's right. Yeah, we see that a lot. And so that happens. But if you are able to stay in a place for a long time and say no to other opportunities that might get you climbing up that financial or social ladder, and instead you release that, you let that go, you sacrifice that, and instead you stay because you are an advocate for the local space, I think it's worth it. But I do also think it's hard. It is sometimes a sacrifice because you're not climbing up the ladder in the way that a lot of people in society are. You're sticking around. You're kind of possibly seen as a bit boring because you're not that mobile. You're just staying in the same place the whole time.
Which makes me wonder, what has the gift of this been for you as someone who's kind of been able to make that choice again and again over the years? And in terms of your own faith and spirituality, how would you distill the gift of it in your experience?
Oh, I think I've been given the gift of depth and meaning, familiarity with people, getting to know people, getting to see people being born, people dying, and being with them in those really sacred moments, and all, you know, outside of religious spaces like the church. So for me, it's very important to discern, as we said before, that the numinous in the neighbourhood. I see that a lot. And so I find that very freeing. And for me, that makes the transcendent bigger for me, that it's not located in one particular space, like the religious space, but it's in the neighbourhood as well. And when we start asking things like, okay, where is the transcendent here in the neighbourhood? We start, I think, seeing beautiful things like relationships being built and connections being made and kind acts, I think, happening to build that infrastructure in the neighbourhood, that social structure or the social capital of the neighbourhood. I see that a lot. And I feel like that's a real gift, or that's a real blessing given to me, to be able to witness what we're working towards with others. To be able to see that manifesting before my eyes is really beautiful and really encouraging in a world where there are a lot of problems. There's a lot of awful things going on in this world, and yet I can see individuals working for good in my neighbourhood, and that gives me a lot of hope today.
Corina, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Corina Kraminski, a long-term and hopeful resident of the inner Sydney neighbourhood of Surry Hills. She's a board member of its Neighbourhood Centre, a Uniting Church minister, an author and a publisher. Her most recent project is Edgewalkers, a new book reimagining faith, church and theology. You can find out more about it on the Soul Search website. And yes, Edgewalkers includes a terrific chapter all about neighbourhoods. By podcast and on Radio National, it's Meredith Lake with you for Soul Search. Knowing your neighbours sounds rewarding, don't you think? But you know, in several traditions, the neighbour ethic goes even deeper than knowledge to love. At least 2,500 years ago, the Jewish Torah laid it out. Love your neighbour as yourself. And you might know the story about the lawyer from a few centuries later. He was keen to clarify the limits of this obligation to neighbour love. In a famous encounter described in the Gospel of Luke, the lawyer asked Jesus, "Who then is my neighbour?" And the reply has had a ripple effect over the centuries ever since, inspiring music, literature, whole areas of moral philosophy, and even the common law of negligence. Dr. Roberta Kwan is a literary scholar, and she's been thinking about neighbour love for years. Hi, Roberta.
Hi, Meredith. Thanks for having me on.
When the lawyer asked this question, who is my neighbour, what answer did he get?
Well, I think very importantly, the first thing to say is that Jesus doesn't actually answer his question.
Ha!
Yes. Which can be a bit frustrating, I guess, when someone doesn't answer your question.
He tells a pretty good story, though.
He tells an excellent story. It's probably quite familiar to many of your listeners, at least the title that we've given to the story, which has become the parable of the Good Samaritan. To put it fairly succinctly, there's an anonymous person lying by the side of the road. The text describes him as, you know, almost dead.
He's been beaten up.
He's been beaten up, robbed. He's in a lot of trouble and he needs help. And remembering that this is a story that Jesus is telling to this lawyer, and a couple of people come along, they're two very religious figures, religious leaders, and it would have been quite surprising, I think, to Jesus' companion to hear that they actually dash across the road to get as far away as possible from this almost dead person and choose not to help him. And then along comes a Samaritan. And for the lawyer and religious figures in the story as well, a Samaritan would have been someone who they looked down on as someone who is culturally different, someone inferior. And yet the way that Jesus tells it is that it's this person who has compassion on him. The word compassion is in the text. And he tends to his wounds. He takes him to an inn, pays for the injured person's future care out of his own pocket. Mm. But most importantly, I think, is Jesus' punchline, which I think sometimes we've missed. And so he actually says, which of the three people in the story do you, lawyer, who I'm talking to, think was a neighbour to the man who fell into the hands of robbers?
What does the lawyer say?
And the lawyer says, the one who had mercy on him. He knew what the answer had to be. But the interesting thing with Jesus' question, as opposed to his answer to the who is my neighbour, you know, I'm not going to tell you who's in or out. I'm not going to allow you to put a hedge around who your neighbour might be and for that to be suitably, you know, comfortable for you. I'm actually going to ask you, can you see yourself as a neighbour to others? And others being anyone you might come across who might be in need, I think, if this story gives us a hint towards who those others might be.
Hmm. So I guess anyone could become a neighbour. Is that kind of the upshot of all this?
I think so, yes. I guess that one of the things we see in that story is that it's a particular someone who the Samaritan didn't necessarily choose to be in the company of, so to speak, you know, to be within proximity of, but there they were thrown together. It could be anyone, but particularly anyone who you can be extending some kindness to, whose need you might actually be able to help to meet.
Mm. Where compassion and mercy might be operative and practical, maybe.
Exactly, yes.
Mm. I mean, it's a story, I guess, I probably first heard it as a kid and I've returned to it on and off over the years. There's actually a lot in it once you slow down and kind of read it with a bit of attention. And it's obviously been a story that's important to the religious communities that consider it, you know, sacred, as imposing a very real obligation. But I actually remember sitting in a law class as an undergrad and coming across this story where I didn't expect it as almost the source of some of our deepest legal principles. I mean, because obviously loving your neighbour is not something you can legislate. You can't legislate love as a positive obligation. But as I learned back then, courts have kind of laid out an obligation to protect one's neighbour from harm or injury. And I remember reading this case and they were kind of talking about, oh, well, okay, well, who's the neighbour that you've got to protect from harm? And it's interesting. It isn't just someone who lives nearby or who's part of your obvious community. It's anyone you could reasonably foresee being impacted by what you're doing. There's this kind of proximity but potential expansiveness to the category of neighbour, even in our law. Anyway, it's just struck me how many echoes this story has had. And I want to ask you, Roberta, about some of the echoes that you've kind of traced, because you're a literary academic and specifically a scholar of Shakespeare's plays. And I want to know why you went looking for the echoes of this story and the neighbour ethic, so to speak, there in the works of Shakespeare. Why'd you do that?
I mean, if I backtrack a little, my PhD research and for several years afterwards was on the question of interpretation, how we see ourselves, how we see the world, how we see others, that I argue was significantly shaped, I guess, by the religious changes that were taking place around Shakespeare's time. And Shakespeare was born in 1564, and my work particularly sort of focuses on early modern period, so roughly 1500 to 1700. Anyway, as I was thinking about interpretation, I realised that there were all sorts of ethical implications. I started to notice this kind of the image of the neighbour, the language of neighbourly love that comes from the religious tradition that was so influential in Shakespeare's time, which was Christianity. It just sort of inflects so much of what happens in Shakespeare's plays. And so that's how I got there.
You know, this whole idea of knowing your neighbour is under pressure in itself, and then loving your neighbour, especially the neighbour who isn't like you, you know, that's under a lot of pressure in our time in all kinds of ways. And I wondered if maybe there was something in our own context that drove you also to that question of neighbour love and maybe how Shakespeare played with it in his also time of tumult.
Yes. I think there is, well, there was, and maybe increasingly so. We still hear echoes of that idea of, you know, love your neighbour as yourself. It's still present in our culture. And yet I did start to wonder, well, is there some way of bringing that idea into the, you know, in very small ways, of course. I'm a literary scholar, but into...
You're going to change the world. Yeah, that's what literary studies is about.
Yes, that's what we'd like to think. But yeah, into public discourse, you know, into the public imagination. You know, I'm talking about today, of course. And I think art and literary texts and plays, theatre, they're a way of actually helping us to maybe expand our moral imagination. And sometimes I think historical works actually help us because they actually give us a glimpse into how people might have thought differently or acted differently or just frame their understanding of themselves and the world in a slightly different way that might...
It can give us a shake-up, can't it? And a fresh set of eyes for something. Just that act of being called to a different kind of attention.
Yes.
And that, I think you're right, that works of art, whatever their genre, can arrest us and call us to that. But I'm guessing, you know, when you looked into this in Shakespeare's plays, that you found quite a fair bit there. I mean, you've kind of flagged the general period when he was writing. In my mind, I'm thinking, wow, okay, this is when England's still, you know, navigating all the upheavals of the Reformation and all that stuff. Why do you think neighbour love was sharp in his time? Just tell me a little bit more about his context.
Sure. I think the first thing I should say was I don't think it was uniquely sharp, I guess, in Shakespeare's time.
Maybe it always is.
Yeah. Yes. And think about the centuries earlier, you know, in the, what we call the medieval period, and there was a real emphasis on neighbourliness then, from what I understand, that's sort of a little bit outside my research. And in fact, I think for many years, historians were arguing that in Shakespeare's time, there was a real decline of neighbourliness, an argument that's really been challenged in the last two or three decades.
Yeah, well, you can see where it's coming from, right? Like, it's a very polarised society. Like, you know, things are really divided.
Yes, and significant social change as well. So urbanisation, poverty, migration, religious conflict. I think it's interesting that people who argued for this decline of neighbourliness notion closely linked it to the Protestant Reformation.
So the idea was that maybe because of the Protestant Reformation, the neighbour love ethic that we've been talking about kind of fell off the boil in early modern England. Is that kind of the guts of it, according
pretty
to
much.
That argument?
Yeah, pretty much, yes. Yeah, and yet I think one of the key features of the Reformation, which is its focus on the Bible and on biblical literacy, is actually why the historians and I guess, certain people would, there's a counter-argument, I guess, that neighbourliness was still very vibrant. It was contested, but it really did continue to permeate. And I think particularly that emphasis on connecting people to the language of the Bible actually gave them a working vocabulary, the imagery for how they organised their social relations, you know, the society.
Okay, right. So you're kind of saying that for all the tumult of the time, for all what I can imagine might have been some anxieties around neighbour love, its boundaries and all those things that were kind of in flux in Shakespeare's day, that in the midst of all that, one of the things that was going on with the Protestant Reformation is a kind of literacy that meant that neighbour love as an ethic stayed really current.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And Shakespeare went in on that.
Yes, and we find it in all sorts of texts as well of the time.
Where do you see him? I just love a couple of examples, and I have to admit, I haven't read all the plays, Roberta. You're going to have to help me here.
Sure.
But where do you see Shakespeare kind of taking up this idea of the neighbour? Maybe an example of where he might portray a good neighbour.
Sure. I'll take you to a play that's has been performed quite often in Australia called As You Like It, a comedy. I don't know if you've seen it, Meredith.
I have, yes.
No, you have? Yes. And we actually have a couple of instances where we see examples of good neighbourliness. So if it's a little complicated, but we've got people who are exiled from the city. They escape in pairs to what turns out to be the Forest of Arden. The first pair is Rosalind and her cousin Celia, but they're disguised as brother and sister. They make the trek out. They're exhausted. And so they happen upon an old shepherd by the name of Corin. Rosalind says, points to her cousin slash sister and says, "Here's a young maid with travel much oppressed and faints for succour, for help." And Corin replies, "Fair sir, I pity her and wish for her sake more than mine own. My fortunes were more able to relieve her." So we've got that sort of disposition there of wanting to help. So he's a shepherd. He works for someone else. "My master is of churlish disposition and little recks to find the way to heaven by doing deeds of hospitality. But what is, come see, and in my voice most welcome shall you be." And hospitality, that welcome of the needy, that practical provision or that offer of provision was all sort of caught up very much in the ideas of neighbour love.
This is Soul Search by podcast and on ABC Radio National. I'm Meredith Lake and I'm here with Shakespeare scholar Dr. Roberta Kwan. And we're chewing over the idea of neighbour love, the ethic of loving your neighbour as yourself, as kind of one of these ideas that was woven right through the social and ethical fabric of Shakespeare's time and that, well, as I'm learning from you, Roberta, crops up in all kinds of ways in his plays. Now, that example you just gave from As You Like It, the shepherd Corin extending welcome, hospitality, assistance to, you know, the traveller worn out from their journey, I'm struck that that's not quite the same thing as charity. He's kind of doing it even though his boss might not be too happy about it. There's something more to this ethic than the rich helping the poor. It makes me think maybe it's more to do with a mutual recognition, a kind of solidarity even. What do you make of that?
Yes, I think you're right, Meredith. And it's a really important aspect of the ethic. It comes in the tale of love your neighbour as yourself. And so we've already talked about who is my neighbour and how that is provocative enough. You know, and I should say that if we go back to the Good Samaritan, that question that the lawyer asks is, it's an age-old question, you know, ever since that time, really. So we've got that question, but then we've got as yourself. And I should also say, I mean, what do we mean by love? You know, as opposed to be nice to.
It's a very dense set of five words,
yes,
isn't it?
It is, indeed. But I think you're asking about the as yourself here. The as yourself actually helps us understand the love there, love in that statement. And I think there's a real reflexivity to what's being set forth here as a way of, you know, relating to others or a way of looking at others. Again, back to the Good Samaritan, it actually starts with seeing myself as a neighbour, then this movement towards the other. So if I actually see myself as a neighbour, then that movement towards not necessarily everyone in this sort of very impractical sort of way, but it could be anyone, which is radical enough. Anyone could be my neighbour. But then there's that movement back, that reflexivity back to as myself. So asking ourselves that question, I guess, I think that's what the ethic is challenging, you know, readers and listeners to do, is how would I like to be loved or treated? And so to do that for the other, you know, again, it's not in any sense an unfamiliar sort of idea.
No, I mean, it's called the golden rule.
The golden rule, exactly.
Yes. Do to other people as you want them to do to you, which in a way is like, oh, yeah, well, we should just do that. But saying, hang on.
Yes.
As yourself, that means I need to know myself. It means to me, I need to know myself in relation to other people. I mean, Shakespeare was preoccupied with what it means to know yourself. Like so many of his plays include whole monologues on that theme, lots of throwaway lines as well. And I mean, we live in an identity preoccupied age ourselves. Mm-hmm. We're always trying to find who am I really? And it's fascinating that this little phrase, love your neighbour as yourself, is part of the answer to who am I? Is that really what this is about?
I think so. So it really pushes against our sort of present-day conceptions, you know, of selfhood. Nancy Selleck has a phrase that I've found so helpful, which is that we've constructed one-person models of selfhood, you know, that have increasingly framed our understanding of that question of identity. You know, who am I? Well, I'm a standalone individual.
We all recognise this idea.
Yes. Yes. But if we go back to both the biblical ethic and to Shakespeare's world, the models of selfhood were not necessarily one-person models of selfhood, and they were much more relational. I saw myself as someone with an ethical obligation to others. The models of selfhood were much more of interpersonal. And I think what's key there is because there was a really strong emphasis on our common humanity or people's common humanity. And so I'm a neighbour to my neighbour because we are all human beings. We share our humanity. And in fact, if I can bring in a quick quote from the time, from perhaps surprisingly from, but maybe not necessarily. So it's John Calvin who is.
All right, okay.
What might be surprising was that his works were like incredibly popular in Shakespeare's time in England. Yeah, just a quote from him. What he says: "He that will exempt himself from relieving his neighbours must get him a new shape and show that he intends to be no more a man. For so long as we be of mankind, we cannot but behold our own face, as it were in a glass, in the person that is poor and despised, yea, though he were further a stranger in the world." Excuse the gendered language there, but yes. But
there's a few things to forgive Calvin for.
Yes, yes. Yes, indeed. But I think we get the point, don't we? There was this real sense that I'm actually undoing my own humanity or our common humanity if I only act in this world as though I am that standalone individual, as though my neighbours don't play a part in constructing that sense of who I am.
I mean, that's really interesting because often, I think we come across this a bit, it is the Protestant Reformation that's cited as one of the root causes of the kind of the highly individualistic conception of the self that has since, you know, been supercharged by all kinds of things, consumer capitalism, for example, mm-hmm. you know, that because of its radical sense of the individual before God, that Protestantism is one of the kind of the seedbeds of the kind of individualism that we live with. And yet you're pointing to, you know, kind of some of the key Protestant writers of that time in a way that suggests, well, there might be more to that story. Maybe a mutuality persisted in a way that we've overlooked in more recent years. But I am struck that many traditions, I'm thinking of Buddhist notions of interbeing, you know, Islamic ideas of neighbour love. We find it in the Quran as well. But I wonder what you think is to be gained now from returning to a sense of ourselves as much more mutual.
You know, in some ways it feels too idealistic. It feels too improbable. If we just maybe step back a bit, you've already started talking about our own culture, but when I think about the idea of loving our neighbour as ourselves, so we're talking about this sort of quite a gritty, uncomfortable sort of idea in many ways. It's quite contrary to many of our cultural currents. Certainly we talked about individualism, you know, that one-person model of selfhood. You know, language matters. So the language we use to talk about, you know, ourselves, our society, you know, other people, actually foregrounding the idea of and the imagery of our neighbour love in our public discourse. I think that matters. You know, there is this real yearning, I think, as well, for connection, for belonging, so neighbourliness more generally, and also, you know, actually have conversations about that kind of more pointy end of the ethic in terms of what actual love looks like as well. And we're talking, again, about a cultural context where research is showing that people have less friends, less socialising. Again, we're talking a lot about loneliness as well. So I think the opportunity to talk about how we might do things differently, I think, you know, if we could even get some sort of a degree of relief from some of these trends, that would be wonderful. And that revitalising of our collective moral imaginations, thinking outside those one-person models of selfhood, outside of, might actually be good for our souls in actually pointing us back to our own humanity individually and collectively. I've been thinking, what does it mean practically when we're having this conversation in the middle of a war? Does it make any difference to how we respond to displaced people, to fuel shortages? Thinking about the latter, not just for myself, but collectively, you know. Yeah, I think it does. Yeah, I think for me when I was thinking about this, that idea of relief, yeah, really came to mind for me.
Dr. Roberta Kwan is a literary academic based in Sydney.
She wrote about the neighbour in the new Routledge Companion to Shakespeare and Religion. And if you head to the ABC Religion and Ethics website, you can read her excellent article there. It's all about how Shakespeare's most political play might just help us recover a sense of neighbourly kindness in our own politics. I'm Meredith Lake, and I'd love to hear from you about your experience of neighbourliness. Email me anytime at soul.search@abc.net.au. And remember, you can listen back to anything that you've just heard by searching for Soul Search on ABC Listen. This episode was produced by Rowan Salmond and Hong Jiang on Gadigal land in Sydney. I'm Meredith Lake, signing off from Arunda Country in Central Australia with good intentions to take that next step towards knowing my neighbours. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.